Good morning, everybody. Welcome to JF Believers Church. If you have a Bible, you can open to Luke chapter 14. Luke chapter 14, we'll read verses 25 to 35. Now great multitudes went with him, and he turned and said to them, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. And whoever does not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. For which of you, intending to build a tower, does not sit down first and count the cost, whether he has enough to finish it? Lest after he has laid the foundation and is not able to finish, all who see it begin to mock him, saying, 'This man began to build and was not able to finish?' Or what king, going to make war against another king, does not sit down first and consider whether he is able with 10,000 to meet him who comes against him with 20,000? Or else while the other is still a great way off, he sends a delegation and asks conditions of peace. So likewise, whoever of you does not forsake all that he has cannot be my disciple. Salt is good, but if the salt has lost its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is neither fit for the land nor for the dunghill, but men throw it out. He who has ears to hear, let him hear."
If you're not already there, then let's go to Luke 14, where Ben was reading. It's our text today. If you're a guest, I welcome you. We are working our way through the life and times of Jesus and trying the best we can to chronologically move through his ministry. We began way back, as you can see this week. What do we got? 84. So I have no idea where we are. Just somewhere out there in the vast life of Christ. So it could be a while yet. Hey, before I begin today, please be in prayer. Those of you that attend here, you know who they are. If you don't, we have two missionaries out of this church that are stationed full-time in the Philippines. They're coming home this week, so it'll be good to see them. They're coming home for a month of rest. Yeah, like those two are going to rest. I think they come home and just work twice as hard when they get here. But they're coming home for a month. They'll be here for the concert down at the church house. The beginning of Stout Year, and to be able to tell us what they're up to and where our missions money's going, and to go up to our sister church in Duluth and do the same up there, and for them to be at church camp. And that's always important for us to all be able to be together as a body. So it's good to bring them home. And I think they're anxious to come home. But they'd only been gone 6 months before they quit calling this place home and began to call Philippines home. So they're not coming home. They're coming back to the United States. Then they'll go back home, in their minds anyway. So just pray that, that they have an easy journey and make it back home. And with me, they're bringing gifts. They got my 12-string with them coming from the Philippines, so it'd be nice to have a new guitar. This one I've been fighting for a while. So God is good, and it's good to have them out there in the field, so please continue to be in prayer for them. Luke 14 is where we are this week, in a very challenging bit of Scripture. Recently, as last week, there was the handling of the issue of the resurrection of mankind and the resurrection of men. There was the story of the raising of Lazarus, and we talked about what was to come hereafter. We spoke of living again after having died. Now today we're going to look rather at the call to die after we've been given the opportunity to live again. Dying to oneself, dying to the world's pursuits, to be a disciple once we have been reborn. We have the baptism coming up here soon at the church campout, and this is what I'm speaking of, really the essence of baptism. In the act of baptism, we put you under the water, and that would symbolize, therefore, the death of self, the resurrection when I pull you back up, if I pull you back up, usually I do, and pull you back up, there is that, again, that picture of the resurrection of that man or woman. Why do we do it publicly? Because there is in this act a public testimony of what has occurred in the life of the one baptized. As I say often, that baptism, we're not doing anything to you there other than making you wet. It's not just for you. It's for everybody that's there. That's why we attend. It's like a wedding. It's your testimony and your permission to hold your feet to the fire. You're saying, I have died to self and I am a new creature. Now, one does not have to walk with Christ for a very long time before he or she begins to see the sides of the road and see that they are strewn with the bodies of those who have traveled on before us and have failed to make it. As much as we'd like to do otherwise, their spiritual corpses are hard to ignore. It's like a traffic accident. We slow down and we stare. They are those who no doubt began the race with the best of intentions. Nobody begins this Christian thing thinking, well, you know, I'll just try it for a while if it doesn't work out. These along the road there, they have, at least at first, they never dreamed of turning back. They never considered that they may not make the finish line. But they failed to consider the cost. They failed to pay attention to the dangers. And there are dangers. Jesus told Peter, Satan longs to sift you like wheat. These people along the roadside there, they trusted in themselves, you see. They trusted in their strength. They trusted in their own stamina, if you will, that they could dance near the flames and survive it. They failed to be resolute. What's that mean, resolute? Well, it's important not only to look at the vernacular of our generation, but the vernacular of the original. Because words change. To be resolute is to, quote, be determined, pointed, earnest, and committed, end quote. Jesus was resolute. He was absolutely unmovable in his purpose. And his purpose was to seek and save that which was lost, Luke 19:10. And when the time came, he quite literally picked up his cross and finished what he started. He finished. Paul the Apostle said, I finished my race. I've completed my course. He finished. After 25 years of standing in this pulpit, I look out at all of you and I wonder how many of you will finish. How many will still be standing when it all comes to a close? Jesus finished it because, above all things, he loved his Father and he loved us. And he clearly knew his purpose. And he knew that at all cost, he was going to complete it. He was firm. He was unwavering. He was resolute. I think that's a rare commodity these days. Resolution. We are a generation, and you know I often complain. It's a sure sign of me getting old, right? That we are a generation that know little about concepts such as loyalty and faithfulness and duty. But that lack does not change the fact that these are the qualities, or at least some of the qualities, that Christ longs to see exude in us, reflected forth from not only us as individuals, but us as churches. The reality is, and I think few would argue, that we live out our lives today in an age or in a culture that oftentimes is just expressed in shades of gray. Nebulous meanings, vague content, fluid word usage. And all of these things provides for a truth that can simply dance in and out of the light. and thereby escaping a pure review. How I long for a world wherein I can nail the feet of truth to the floor. And I think that's, however, unlikely anytime soon. We are, I think, a post-truth age. I heard a newscaster say that the other day. Just took my breath away. She goes, here, when she's expressing something, it's referred to this as the post-truth age. Because the reality is, we live in an age where few men and women really want emphatic truth. They really want, you know, absolute verity. Because the problem about absolutes is absolutes call for an answer. We can't ignore absolutes. I mean, you know, undeniable facts, they require a reply, a response in light of that truth. And I mean, come on, why put yourself through it? Why not simply just drift around in the ambiguous fog, really, of situational ethics and social relativism? We just can just ramble around out there, and there is no footing. That way, anything I do can be justified. Any way I live, any choice I make can be thereby righteous. Even if it makes sense to nobody else and it absolutely defies the laws of gravity, it doesn't matter because it's my law of gravity. Let me give you an example that I find astonishing. And some of you are aware of this. Science says that it adheres to certain laws and principles that are absolute and unchanging. We hear that often. Now, one of these rules, you might remember this from high school, is the second law of thermodynamics. Okay? Second law of thermodynamics. Now, of all the laws of science, they actually don't get any simpler and easier to understand than this one. In fact, Albert Einstein called this the most basic law of science. So this is the law of the laws. And the idea in this law is that all things move from order to disorder. From order to chaos. It's called entropy. Again, nice words that maybe you don't use in your normal everyday language. But that's something that so much of science is based on, this law, quote unquote. Yet that concept that is so tightly held by the science community absolutely flies in the very face of evolution, which they also say they believe. Now, evolution, if you try to go against evolution, well, you're just an idiot. You're just a hick, okay? I mean, where are you from? You from the woods? You know, what do you know about, you know, they just go on like you're just an idiot, okay? However, evolution goes against what they say they believe. Because evolution is a universal movement from chaos to order, from random to organized, meaning things are going from messed up to better. It's moving more and more in that direction. So which is it? Well, it depends on the day. And it depends on what argument they're arguing and the point they're trying to make. See, until we understand the absolute meanings of words like truth, faithfulness, commitment, love, we certainly are never going to be able to live them out with any consistency because we don't know what they mean. This battle, this quandary, if we can put it that way, that is here and presented in this passage this morning, it is born out of this kind of wordplay. It is born out of an unwillingness to declare an absolute. By God? Oh, no. By Christ the day he delivered it? No. By us, friends. By us. Because, see, we tend rather in our Christian lives, if you are at all a confessing Christian this morning, we rather tend to invest in the tweaking of our faith here and there a little. That's our lives. The ebb and the flow of a particular element of Christianity, you know, as they individually rise to our attention, depending on what the pastor spoke from the pulpit last week or a book we're reading on at the time, we kind of get convicted about a little thing like that. So we begin to start to tweak our lives and kind of nudge and kind of just kind of move a little to the left or move a little to the right. And what happens is that ends up being the nature of our living. The rise and the fall of the Christ proximity. Well, I'm a little closer, I'm a little further away, and oh, I'm having a hard time, I'm moving away. Oh, I'm a little closer now, and oh, the rules, I got to get better on the rules. I got to do better in the efforts and the better and the worse and all this gobbledygook. But seldom do we actually acknowledge the elephant in the room. For to declare its reality, to declare its presence would mean then we have to deal with that elephant. And what am I going to do with an elephant? I mean, I don't know what to feed an elephant. So we just pretend it's not there. The stark reality this morning, the taboo subject that is at hand, and it most definitely is at hand in this passage, is the wide chasm between the believer and the disciple. Between those who are just trying to stay out of hell and those who want to move the world. Between those who seek to be a religiously motivated good person and those who are inclined to participate in the spiritual version of Spain's running of the bulls. You know, they're crazy. Y'all know what I'm talking about, don't you? Those people. And words like radical and bond slave and on mission and these kind of words, they enthrall us, and yet they still kind of secretly make us bristle a little too, don't they? Because we don't want to cause a ruckus. You know, we don't want to cause problems. We don't want people to not like us. We don't want people to think we're in some kind of cult. I mean, why do you have to be so radical? Why do you have to use words like that? I think it'd be like knowing that we can't afford that fast little sports car that we want. But we're also told at the same time that it's already paid for. It's free. We're dangling the keys. You know, the pastor does that Sunday mornings. He's saying, here you go. Because the problem is we know, okay, pastor, it's free, but, you know, there's the whole upkeep and the insurance and the lower miles per gallon. So all of that stuff just keeps us from actually getting behind the wheel. So we just drive by the car lot every morning and we look at it. We wonder about those people who actually drive one of those things, you know, and they pass us really fast with that crazy grin on their face and their hair blowing in the wind. We wonder about their lives. That's many of us this morning when it comes to disciple Christianity. It's like pining for some girl and just spending your lifetime admiring from afar like some sort of creepy stalker. I mean, you know, you think in your mind, okay, she's really hot and all, but, you know, if I stepped forward, things could get messy. I mean, this could be hard. And, you know, I mean, relationship with her, I mean, it could be time-consuming, could be difficult. I'll probably mess up and put my foot in my mouth. She might hurt my feelings. My comfortable, all-controlled life here might get upended. So I'll just stay over here where it's safe, and I'll just, you know, dream of a life together, a life of marriage and communion and relationship. I'll pass on the sex and the high interactive love relationship. I mean, it's a nice dream, but again, for many of us, that describes our Christian life. Jesus had a way a characteristic, if you will, and if you're a student of the Word, you know this, that encompassed the whole of his life and the whole of his message. This was a characteristic of his ministerial style. And it's something that the wider church today is working so very hard to ignore or so very hard to erase. It is the fact that Jesus taught a message that quite frankly embraced an all or nothing motif. And there it is. There's the elephant in the room. We know what he said. We know the all-encompassing heart behind his message, all or nothing. And I think this morning, few aspects of Christianity trouble the masses more than this one. And the irony of it is the world, the secular world out there, the unbelieving, let's put it this way, unfollowing world, they actually are more ready to grasp this than most people sitting in pews right now, this moment, across this country. I mean, we want to believe in degrees of Christianity, don't we? Levels of faith. And the idea that he wants everything, well, that's just troubling. For many of us this morning, quite frankly, it makes us uncomfortable. The idea makes us squirm a little in the pew there, and we break eye contact, and we kind of look away a little because we know. But I mean, seriously, really, Pastor? Hate my mother? Come on. That's just over the top. Well, firstly, we know that Christ is not speaking those words in some sort of singular standalone idea. This isn't one of the Ten Commandments. Number four, hate your mother. That's not what's happening here. It's in the context of a concept spoken in a hyperbole to once again dramatically show us, to emphasize the magnitude of the message, to show us the sheer size of the elephant. Our love, our commitment, our sold out position to Christ and the kingdom must be so high that our love for mom would look like hatred in comparison. Now, for some of us, that might be comforting. Some of us goes, yeah, still, nah. Still doesn't make me feel good. But nobody can deny the fact that Jesus, in this passage, he is seriously throwing down. Hatred. Wow. See, there you go, Pastor. That's exactly what I'm talking about, Pastor. That's exactly the issue. Why so extreme? I mean, why? It's so over the top. Can't we just be a nice church-going folks who don't engage in extracurricular sex and we don't snort cocaine? No. No, it's not enough. It's religion, but it's not Christianity. Our faith must be more than just not doing bad stuff and going to church on Sunday. And you know how I feel about this, and you know I preach it all the time. If that is your case, you are wasting your time and you need to stay in bed on Sunday mornings. You're wasting a great morning to sleep in because you ain't getting any points in heaven. It's not doing you any good. It's not doing God any good. It's not blessing you. It's not glorifying God. It doesn't bless the kingdom. It doesn't bless the church. It's just dead weight. Why would you get out of bed? You say, well, you don't have to be rude. No, but I do have to wake you up. And I do have to be a straight shooter as a pastor, just as Jesus was a straight shooter. A butterfly doesn't just fly on Sundays. You know, Monday through Saturday, he's a caterpillar, crawls around, and then, you know, Sunday morning, gets out them wings and flies out. No, he's committed. I mean, he has moved into the no turning back mode. And they're all over. Because, have you noticed just the past week, it's like every caterpillar in the entire Dunn County has turned into a butterfly. It's just awesome. Of course, I just love butterflies. I dodge them with my car. I'm going to kill myself. You know, it's like, yeah, he tried to dodge a butterfly and hit an oncoming car. Now he's dead. You know, I believe this morning that Satan's greatest coup is to convince believers that Jesus is sold in bite-sized portions. And maybe you think like the old Lay's potato chips commercial, you can just eat just one. And so we start out with the best intentions. We're going to be great. We're going to move. We're going to do great things with Jesus. And we move forward and we move forward and move forward. And we finally get to a point where there's a throwdown. We're like, whoa. No, that's it. And the amazing thing is God will let you. Straw, line, sand. This isn't an exception. This generally is the rule of Christendom in America. Why? Can't let it touch my family. Family first, right? No. Absolutely, positively not. Family first is not a biblical concept. It is a worldly religious concept. If Jesus ain't first, good luck with your family. Well, I got a job. I got things to do. I got to make my million before I'm 30. I'm in love. I know I shouldn't be sleeping with her. I'm not married to her, but we're going to get married. So it's okay. It's okay. I got a special deal. God's cool with this. No, God ain't cool with this. In fact, making that plunge will probably ruin what could be a blessed thing. And the list just goes on and on. We hold back. Jesus said, whoever of you that does not forsake all that he has cannot be my disciple. Wow. The word forsake in this verse means to bid farewell, to take leave, to send away, to separate, to renounce. All? I know. Right about now you're thinking, Pastor, does this mean I, like the rich young man in Mark 10, I have to sell all that I have and give it to the poor? Maybe. Maybe. I, you know, it'd be lovely for me not to go, oh, no, it'll be okay. You can have all that stuff. Yeah, well, that's American kind of thinking. I guess it depends on just how tightly you're holding on to that stuff and what it's doing to you, owning it. The premise here, you see, guys, is not the stuff. Remember, the passage wasn't that the problem was money. It was rather the problem was the love of money. There are some people out there that just got money, and it's running out their ears, and it's not corrupting to them at all. And it's like the more they give it away, the more they get, and they just, God has just chosen to bless them because they can handle it. Now, me, I'm not one of those. We have to ask ourselves about the desire for the control of this stuff over us. You see, what Jesus is after here is a serious approach to sin and our walk with him. I've used the comparison so often. It is amazing, especially when it's Olympics time. Man, we admire them, don't we? We look at those guys and it's like, man, what dedication. You look at the long distance runners. It's like, wow, man, that's just, God, that's just awesome, man. I mean, you've just poured in your life, just gave over everything to this, to get that gold medal. That's so awesome. Try that with Jesus. Mm-hmm. So somehow I don't think that the world around you and your family are going to support you in that same way. They will for a little piece of gold to hang around your neck. But for eternity, for the creator of the universe, the God who made everything? Well, no, that's crazy. That's radical. That's cultish. You're nuts. Don't do that. What's the matter with you? What kind of church are you going to? I remember one young man coming to me once. I can still see it in my mind. Handing over his laptop to me and said, I can't have this. I won't get into why. And no, it's not what you think. No, I can't have this. Handed over his laptop. He forsook his computer in order to be a disciple. But I bet there's things in your mind you thought, oh, now, wait a minute. My girlfriend? No. My family? They're my family. How un-American. My job? Hey, it's not easy to get jobs these days. And the list goes on and on and on. Let's ask ourselves the unthinkable this morning. Is anything in my life standing between me and Jesus? Is anything standing between me and radical living, between me and being a real disciple? You know what that is that's out there? That's a God. Small g. Yeah. See what you think? It's little statues. I don't got any of them. I'm not worshiping any false gods. Oh, we're much more developed and advanced now in our age. Our gods are much shinier, much more expensive. We got to build a little house with giant doors just to put them in, don't we? Is anything in my life standing between me and being a real disciple? Because you know what? The first disciples, them boys sealed their commitment to Christ with their own blood. With their own blood. And we're like, oh, I got a splinter. I can't do this. I got a splinter. How about us this morning? I mean, these boys, again, they were in for a penny. They were in for a pound. They walked away from their livelihood. They walked away from their security. They walked away from their family. They were all in. And please don't misquote me. I'm not telling you to diss your family. Unless they stand in your way between you and Jesus. You guys know that I'm crazy about my wife. I feel like we got married last week. 37 years later. But she knows, thou shalt not get between me and my God. And I'm afraid I'll always be the number two man in her life. But you know what? Number two is pretty good when the number one is Jesus. So I'm not telling you, you know, to totally diss all these things. I get misquoted. I'm just saying, thou shalt not have any other gods before him. And that one is one of the big ten. These guys gave up everything. Do you know that the Greek word for witness is martyr? Oh, that changes everything. Because we're like, are you a witness for Jesus Christ? Yes, I am. Are you a martyr for Jesus Christ? No. Remember our Indian shirts last year we went to India? Adventure, yes. Cannibals, no. We had a chance to go into a certain area where there's still cannibals, and we all voted no. But I tried to lose as much weight so they'd eat everybody else, you know. I mean, we know and we use the term martyr in our day. And we clearly understand it to mean, quote, one who lays down his life for a cause. Martyr. the man who witnessed for Christ in those first centuries after Christ departed. He usually paid for it with his life. They fed him to the lions in the Colosseum. They put him in boiling cauldrons of oil. And sometimes there's guys like, you know, John, who they did that to, and he wouldn't die. You got to meet this guy, right? They crucified him. They exiled him. They confiscated all of their property. Why? Why did they do this? Was it because the world at that time was full of loathing towards Jesus Christ? We think the answer to that is yes, but actually and ironically, it was not. No, it was not the case. Was it because they hated this new religion? No, it really was not. Was it because they objected to having another god, small g, to add to the hundreds they already recognized? No. I mean, in Athens, they had all kinds of gods. Any kind of god you could think of, and they had a monument for each one of them. All the streets were lined with gods. Remember the story where Paul went in there? I mean, so many that perhaps we might have overlooked one someplace. I mean, Paul said, as I walked along, I noticed an altar to an unknown god. You know, so maybe they overlooked one. I mean, now the people of that time, they were happy to add Jesus and Jehovah to their already long list, their trove of gods. It wouldn't have been a problem at all. I mean, they were pantheists after all. The more the merrier. God was in everything. I mean, what's one more god? But you see, the disciples, they wouldn't go along with that. They just had to stick to beehive, didn't they? Why? Couldn't they just go along? Wouldn't we all just be a lot better if we just played nice Christian? But the attitude with these boys was, we'll die first. And they often did. But make no mistake, they didn't die because they brought a new god to the table. They died because they said he was the only one. And the rest of them were all false gods, and they just needed to step back. They died because of the radical aspect of Christ and him only. Now, believer, you can relate to this, right? People aren't really offended you go to church. That's nice. That's a nice Christian American thing to do. Good for you. Especially if you're kind of screwed up. You know, and then, you know, your aunts and uncles and extended family are like, oh, thank God, that's good. Church is good for you. That's very nice. They don't mind. The world doesn't mind. Your workmates, they don't mind. They think, well, good, you won't rip them off. You know, you're one of those church-going people. That's all right. But try throwing down and saying, Jesus is my everything, my all in all. He gets first and the last and everything in between. And you're a nut, you're a radical, and you'll know what they'll say about your church. But please, you know, just for the record, I didn't write this. I didn't write this. Jesus said this. You know, Jesus, the Son of God, the one who died on the cross for save us of our sins, the basis for Christianity, Christianity, it's all about him. He said this. I didn't say this. I'm not washing my hands of it. I'm just saying you can't point at JFB saying, well, their church is crazy. Crazy for just looking at the Bible and seeing what Jesus said. I guess we're crazy then. The world, again, has not changed very much. That kind of life is crossing the line. And you're going to lose some public opinion if you go down that road. Some of you go, yeah, I know, and that's why I haven't gone. There is the historical account of the death, the martyrdom of Polycarp. Y'all know who he is? He was the pastor of the church in Smyrna. There's the Polycarp Bible. Maybe that's where you've heard that name before. You know, Polycarp had just toned it down a little. If he had just went along, everything would have been fine. He wasn't being asked to give up his belief in Jesus. He wasn't. That wasn't the rub. The Roman procurator of Smyrna, in the province of Asia, said, Polycarp, if you will say, Kyrios Caesar, Caesar's Lord, you will live. Just say it, man. Just say all religions are okay. Just say they're all the same. Pick a god. Just say it. It'll all be okay. But the old pastor of that church stood before the procurator and said, it will be Kyrios Eisos, and Jesus alone is Lord. And he died. And they burned him to death in the public square, in the marketplace of Smyrna, because he just wouldn't go along. So in case you're thinking that this is a new battle, it's been going on since the beginning. Bite-sized pieces, bite-sized pieces. Everything or nothing. So emphatic. Jesus is what he said he was, or he this morning is an indescribably wicked imposter. There is no in-between. He cannot be a good teacher and a great man. And wow, he's told us some really good things, and he's an awesome teacher, and wow, I really follow a lot of things he says. Okay, he said that he was God in flesh, and that if you don't repent of your sin, eat of his flesh and drink of his blood, that you will die for and be away from him for eternity. Well, I don't believe that. Well, then he was a nut. Not a good teacher, he's a crazy man. Jesus said, I am the light of the world. That's pretty bold. He said, I am the door to life, to heaven and to God. He said, I am the good shepherd. He said, I am the resurrection and I am the life. He that believes in me shall never die. Oh, come on. He said, I am the Christ, the Son of the Highest, of the Blessed. Are these things true? Are they not? Choose, believer. There's nothing ambiguous about these statements. Jesus was all in. The great apostle and disciple Paul once wrote, and from a jail cell, no less, for preaching, he said, for me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. Philippians 1:21. So listen, believer, this morning. If for me to live is money, to die is a loss. If for me to live is the world, to die is a loss. If for me to live is pleasure, to die is a loss. For me to live is sin, to die is a loss. If for me to live is self, to die is a loss. But for me to live is Christ, to die is gain. And I don't mean just this morning the mortal cessation of life. I'm not talking about just when your heartbeat stops. I'm not advocating let's all go out and drink the green Kool-Aid, okay? You know, life is awesome, especially right now. I mean, it's August. It's beautiful. The butterflies are out, man. The apples are out. Pick some apples, people. Okay? This is good. This is that narrow wonderful Dunn County wonder, okay? Don't talk to me in January. I'm grumpy. So I'm not just talking about dying in the common sense, but I'm not talking about even just later on. But to die to this world now, to me, is a gain. Some of you, you know what I'm saying, and at least in your heart, you're saying amen. I mean, I gain purpose. I gain peace. Oh, yeah, but you're going to gain persecution. Yep. There's going to be a bunch of people that ain't going to like you. Yeah. You're going to cause a ruckus. Probably your own family's going to be all upset. Probably. Thankfully, mine was Christians, but they still got upset because, you know, we all went into the ministry. So nobody ever came home. I ain't seen my little brother in what, a decade? Why? Well, he's a minister and I'm a minister and he's in Colorado. When will we see each other? Where am I going to meet? Nebraska? Somebody has to die to get all of us kids together. Sisters married to a pastor? They weren't happy about that either. I bet they're happy about it now, though. Because they're gone on. I gain vision, I gain clarity, I gain relationship, I gain fulfillment. See, if you're one of those people that go, I just need to know what my purpose is. I know what mine is. That's why I got this stupid smile on my face. And there's a whole bunch of people in this room. They know. They know what their purpose is. They know why we're here. Remember the t-shirts we made a while back? It said, I know why I'm here, do you? Whether we live, whether we die, we are the Lord's. Romans 14:8. That's the Christian faith. See, to a disciple, it's not just first. It's everything. Now, Jesus wrapped up this very hard-hitting passage, this incredible throwdown, by stating, salt is good, but if the salt has lost its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? Well, what's that got to do with anything? Did he just change gears there? What's that got to do with anything he's been saying about? Everything. Actually, everything. Because salt's inherent qualities are flavor and to preserve. That's us, Christian. That's why we're here. We add some flavor. Can you imagine? Let's take every born-again believer out of this country in one instant. Oh, God help us. I hope you have a conceal and carry permit. Because we're adding the flavor and we're adding the preservative. And when we're gone, so goes the Holy Spirit. His point here is that we're the salt. We're the salt. We are theoretically the Christian, quote unquote. And I say theoretically because I have no idea about any of you. But if we lose the qualities of real discipleship, his version, not the American version, Christ's version, then maybe the world will look at us and say, oh yeah, sure. Yeah, that guy, I work with him, he's Christian. Oh sure, they're salt, they're a Christian. But are we good for anything? Salt's still salt. At least on the surface, even if it's lost its flavor, it's lost all of its qualities, it's still salt. It's just not good for anything. And maybe you're a believer today, but are you good for anything? It is neither fit for the land nor for the dunghill, but men throw it out. Wow, that's rather stark. They throw the salt away because it doesn't do what salt was supposed to do. And Jesus finishes all this by saying, hey, he who has ears, let him hear. So what about it, believer? Do you have ears? Do you hear this today? Or will you just continue to ignore the elephant in the room? Let's stand.